May it please the court.
Yes, thank you.
My name is Jeannie Willoughby, and I'm here on behalf of Carmen Deck. In argument one and two of the brief, we raised the questions of if, as post-conviction counsel, you've raised a claim that the trial counsel was ineffective for failing to adequately conduct the death qualification of voir dire, what does post-conviction counsel then need to do to prove that claim if that claim is set for hearing? And in this case, what occurred is in claim 8F of the amended motion, we asserted that given the entire circumstances of this case, including that Carmen Deck's entire defense in, or entire case for life without parole was based on his bad childhood, and including other circumstances, which I'll go through here in a minute, that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to, during death qualification, ask the jury panel whether or not they would automatically ignore evidence of child abuse and neglect during the formative years, or whether they would meaningfully consider that in determining mitigation. So that was the claim, and the court set the claim for evidentiary hearing. So at this point, there's case law, which is set forth in the amended motion, that in the Court of Appeals, that requires us to actually prove that a biased juror served on the jury. So we filed a motion to contact the jury. And in that motion, we specifically set forth that we would ask the question that counsel was ineffective for failing to ask. The court prohibited us from any contact with the jurors. Then what occurred is the hearing is held. The trial attorneys testified at the hearing that they had no strategy reason for not asking the question. The court took judicial notice of the record and would have had access to the entire voir dire proceedings. But the court ultimately denied the claim because we failed to prove prejudice, which would have required us to call a juror. So in other words, what we're asserting in argument one and two is that, in effect, you're not able to prove an ineffective assistance of counsel claim for failing to adequately the voir dire, failing to adequately conduct the voir dire when you don't allow post-conviction counsel to contact the jurors or call them.
Was it clear to the trial court that you were not going to be asking about what happened in the jury room, or was the trial court concerned that you couldn't make that distinction between asking what they would have done in voir dire since now we were later?
The circuit court did not give much input as to what was the basis of his decision. Basically,
what was argued then?
Right. I argued the motion. There was a motion to contact the jurors. Within the claim of the amended motion itself, we put that we would need to contact the jurors to ask this question. If you have been asked during voir dire this question, what would your response have been? And the question was, would you automatically reject evidence of childhood as mitigation? So we put that in the motions to contact, both motions to contact the jurors. We put that in the amended motion also, that would be the question. In other words,
And what did the state argue in opposition below?
They didn't really, or actually the first motion to contact the juror, there was some mix-up, and the attorney general's office was not there. And they didn't file, after we filed the amended motion, of course, under Rule 2915, they have 30 days to file a response or a motion to dismiss a claim without a hearing. And there was no argument. And then when we filed the motion to renew contact with the jurors, the motion court just immediately denied it. The circuit court did, when we initially filed the motion to contact the jurors, he did initially say that's an attempt to impeach the verdict.
Are you saying we should not give trial courts discretion, or that it was abused here because of the nature of your claim?
It was abused here. Okay. They do have discretion to prohibit contact with the jurors per this court's decision in Strong versus State. But in this particular circumstance where we asserted a critical question that counsel should have asked, on a record where the jurors were not asked sufficient questions, on a record where the client's entire case for mitigation was his bad childhood. There was no other mitigation. It was only the abuse and neglect that he suffered as a child. And we asserted when trial counsel testified at the post-conviction hearing, part of the testimony that he provided, although I think that this court could also consider that, you know, generally it's known that in our society there are individuals who think that the abuse excuse is used too often. It's a prevalent perception in our society that criminal defendants all too often use abuse and neglect to try to get out of something. And so they needed to ensure that there weren't going to be, that these potential jurors were going to be jurors that were at least open to the possibility of listening, because they were listening to the abuse and neglect evidence, because there was a lot of it. And that was, as I said, the entire case. The court also has to consider other circumstances in this case, and that is that the attorneys knew beforehand, having worked on death penalty cases before, they were familiar with the fact that it was not uncommon, and they testified, or one of the attorneys testified, that it was frequent that capital defendants do have a history of child abuse and neglect, that he was familiar that in those cases, a textbook argument by the state is that it's not an excuse, and child abuse and neglect should not be used to spare someone's life. They were aware of this before the voir dire.
Did they say they had no strategy, or did they say they just didn't think they needed to ask about that, and there was that one question from the state on that?
Right. One of the attorneys testified that he believed asking such a question would push it, like, you know, that. And the other attorney testified that he didn't have a trial strategy reason for not asking that, and in the future he would add it to his questions for future trials.
Wasn't there some questions during the death qualification regarding the use of experts for that purpose? And that's
yes.
Where this evidence was going to come through, right? So they, in a sense, they at least one of the counsels thought that they covered that by the way they asked about the experts.
During the general voir dire, they told the jury that they were going to present expert witnesses, but my recollection of the voir dire, the general voir dire, is they didn't say what the experts would be testifying about. I think when a juror asked, what do you mean by expert, he gave an explanation about the difference between an expert and a lay witness in terms of a car accident. But I don't believe, I'm pretty certain that they did not explain that we're going to have a child development expert and we're going to have a child psychiatrist. In addition, this court has to consider that as far as I could ascertain, there was not any, the attorneys didn't prepare any specific death penalty questionnaire that you often see in these cases, where it's sent to the panel beforehand and the panel is provided with questions specific to the death penalty. So that wasn't available in this case. In addition, the court must consider that during the death qualification, the defense didn't ask any questions of six of the jurors. So six of the people who ultimately served on the jury were not asked any questions at all. That occurred during the third death qualification.
Is the lost jury questionnaire issue now removed from the case? You found the jury questionnaires, is that correct?
I don't wish to waive that issue, but I did stipulate that it appears what the Attorney General's office has found appears to be what the questionnaires that we had been seeking.
And do those address any of these issues about, do they ask questions about this issue?
Right, and that assists, in a way, this argument, in my opinion, because it didn't really provide any information about this issue with mitigation, or it didn't assist me either, though. It didn't assist me in the sense that it did. There was nothing prejudicial written on the questionnaires.
Okay.
During the first F qualification, one ultimate juror was asked if she could consider mitigation, and she said yes. During the first death qualification, another juror was asked questions about whether she could listen to the opinions of other jurors, but she was not asked any questions about whether she could consider mitigation. So that's a total of seven jurors, Juror Stumberg from the first death qualification, and six jurors from the third death qualification that were not even asked if they could consider mitigation. And they were not asked that by the state either. So you have seven total that were not even asked if they could consider mitigation. During the second death qualification, you did have four that were asked if they could consider mitigation, and they said yes. But the point being that under the entire circumstances of what the defense was in this case, combined with the fact that there is prevalent, or we're asserting there is prevalent in our society, a bias against criminal defendants using child abuse to explain behavior, that made it necessary in order to ensure that Carmen Deck got a fair death penalty phase, that made it necessary for counsel to explore that area to uncover any potential bias. Another thing that this court has to consider is that child abuse and neglect is not a statutory mitigator. So, for example, age is a statutory mitigator, so the jury will get a specific instruction on that. You know, you shall consider, in determining mitigation, you shall consider the defendant's young age. Here, because child abuse and neglect is not a statutory mitigator in Missouri, an instruction like that was not provided to the jury. This court also must consider that in the direct appeal, Rosemary Percival, the direct appeal attorney, raised an issue that before the voir dire, this court denied the issue, but before the voir dire, the jury was not given a standard pattern instruction, MAI CR 3rd, 300.03A, which is required in every case before the death penalty qualification, that part of the voir dire. The trial court is required to give this instruction, which sets forth all the steps, and which sets forth that part of the jury's duties will be to consider and weigh the mitigation. This court must also consider that this was a legally permissible question. I've seen this asked before in transcripts that I've had in post-conviction cases where the trial attorney inquires during death qualification, we intend to present evidence of this person's childhood. Will you automatically reject that evidence? Or will you at least consider that or be open to the possibility of that in considering mitigation? And I cited State versus Davis in the brief. That's where the trial attorneys moved to disqualify a veneer person because they felt that, or it was their position that veneer person had said, I'm not going to give that any weight. But actually, upon looking at the veneerman's questionnaire and his answers, this court held that, well, he didn't say he would totally ignore that evidence. He did say he would at least look at child abuse and consider it. So therefore, he would be able to sit on the jury. But I only point that out to show that this is a legitimate question that is asked under Morgan versus Illinois and Eddings versus Oklahoma. A death penalty jury is required to consider mitigation. I wanted just to go through a few more things, and that is that under case law, the Court of Appeals, we're required to show that a biased juror sat on the jury under the cases that I cited in the brief from the, I believe it's the Western District and the Eastern District. And in this particular case, as I said before, we specifically notified the state and the motion court that we were not going to ask the jury about anything that had to do with their deliberations or that occurred in the jury room. I also wanted to point out that there are certain local rules, that local judicial circuit court rules, that prohibit contact with the juries. But when I reviewed the local rules, that's only in three judicial circuits. So that was in on the east part of the state. Most of the circuits didn't have any rule prohibiting contact. I also wanted to point out that this court, or in other post-conviction cases, jurors have been called. In Zink versus State, that case is not cited in my brief, but that's at 278 Southwest 3rd, 170. My co-counsel on that post-conviction case deposed jurors with regard to the issue of a leg restraint, so that was a shackling issue. There's other cases cited in my brief where jurors have testified before. There's also one that I didn't cite in the brief, which is State versus Taylor at 917 Southwest 2nd, 222. And in that case, a couple of the jurors went to the law library during an overnight recess to find out what the punishment would be on the ACAs compared to the substantive offenses. And then they later acquitted the man of the ACAs and convicted him of substantive offenses. In that particular case, the trial judge provided the two attorneys with the information, you know, the jurors' names and phone numbers. So the trial judge provided information from the questionnaires, and the defense attorney called the jurors, and the prosecutor obtained an affidavit. Ultimately, that was not successful for the defense because they found that actually the jurors doing the research helped the defense.
Is there any case that is Missouri or elsewhere that has addressed this sort of going back and asking the voir dire question you should have asked, whether you can do that?
I could not find that particular case. I found an Eighth Circuit case where they... Well, I have the Wynn case, the Texas appeals case in the brief, and then last night I found this case that I should have found before, but it's an Eighth Circuit case, and they find that counsel was deficient for failing to ask a voir dire question, but then they didn't find prejudice, and that was Sanders versus Norris. It wasn't the same question that's involved here. And Sanders versus Norris is 529 F3rd 787. It was a different circumstance, but they did, the state of Arkansas had found that the attorney's performance was fine. And then the Eighth Circuit said, we don't understand why they would have found that not sufficient. We think that was sufficient. We think he should have asked a question.
But did they rely simply on the nature of the question, or was there questioning of the jurors who served as to what their answer would have been?
Right. Well, that case is very fact-specific. I mean, it was a case where a questionnaire, one of the jurors on his questionnaire wrote that he was a coroner, and they said that counsel should have followed up and found out if he was involved with the bodies of the victims. And actually, he didn't conduct the autopsy, but he, I guess, was present during some part of it. So it was really very fact-specific. And in the Wynn case, which is cited in the brief, they did consider the entire voir dire, and they found that in the Wynn case, it's a little more difficult because they found cumulative error. The trial counsel was deficient in other respects as well. But they found that he didn't ask enough questions. It was just general, can you be fair questions. And they found his performance during the voir dire to be deficient. But specifically, I didn't find
is there any case finding a judge reversing because a judge did not allow jurors to be questioned?
Right. There's cases along those lines. You know, you have Ham versus South Carolina, where the trial judge did not ask about race, and again, they there was no questions about racial prejudice, and the United States Supreme Court found reversed on that and found that it infringed upon the defendant's right to an impartial jury. Then you have Morgan versus Illinois. That's very basic, where they found that the trial judge should have asked, are you automatically going to impose the death penalty?
I was actually trying to ask, you're saying we should reverse because the trial court abused its discretion in not allowing defense counsel to talk to the jurors to ask them this voir dire question. And I was asking, I know you haven't found a case quite similar to that in the facts, but are there other cases that Missouri or elsewhere that have reversed a conviction for failure to allow counsel to talk to the jurors?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
Where would be the line? Where would you draw the line on what trial counsel would be able to ask the jury about potential voir dire questions and how it would affect them?
I think that if your primary defense, I keep calling it defense, case for life, mm-hmm. is child abuse and neglect during the formative years. I mean, I don't think you can say, oh, if Carmen had 21 different placements and was physically abused and starved and all these things, mm-hmm. I don't think you can go that extent. But I think that you can generally make sure that they're not going to automatically reject the defense itself, the heart of the defense itself. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly. I mean, I think you can go into a little bit of what your defense is going to be. I don't think you can go into a lot of the specific facts mm-hmm. of the case.
Are you suggesting that counsel would always be ineffective? In other words, if he had a legitimate trial strategy, let's assume that he did, that you would always be ineffective for failure to test the waters of that legitimate trial strategy during voir dire?
No, and not in every case. I think this particular case really cried out for it because they knew that the state was going to argue, mm-hmm. which they commonly do, the trial attorney said, he's using abuse as an excuse. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what happened to you as a child. It's no reason to spare someone's life. So I guess, and the you know, in my opinion, Carmen Deck really did have a lot of mitigation. I mean, there was a lot of evidence of traumatic childhood. I mean, there was a lot. It wasn't just a little. It was his whole childhood. So I think under the particular circumstances of this case, and like I said, I think also because parts of their voir dire was lacking anyway, like six of the jurors, or it was seven jurors, weren't even asked if they could consider mitigation. And it wasn't necessarily their general voir dire that was the problem. It was the death qualification. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court.
May I proceed?
On the on this particular issue, the court really doesn't have to get into the thorny issue of how far should this go. I think in Strong, it held that you cannot introduce juror testimony in a post-conviction case to try to prove Strickland prejudice on failure to ask questions during jury selection. And that's where the line is now, and that's a good place for it.
Why can't you do that?
Well,
what if the court had allowed that to be done here and the jurors had, and a juror had said, I just don't buy that stuff. I'm never going to listen to it in any case.
Because that would be, there's a tension here between proving Strickland prejudice and impeaching the verdict. What you would have then is a situation where any PCR counsel practically any, even the most experienced, can think of a question that should have been asked during jury selection that wasn't asked, and then moved to contact all the jurors in the case and attempt to, whatever, shake them from whatever answer that may have
but
been.
But you're saying it would be an abuse of discretion for the trial judge to let them do it.
I think it would.
Which is a different issue. But.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's where Strong draws the line. It would be an abuse of discretion for a post-conviction court to allow contact with jurors to prove prejudice.
But then how is it fair for you in your argument to say they failed to prove prejudice from failure to ask the voir dire question because we don't know what they didn't show any jurors would have answered it, how that jurors would have answered it? You can't have it both ways. Both say in your second in response to their second one, they have to show prejudice by showing it, there was some juror who would have been stricken for that reason.
Well,
but you can't ask the jurors, so you can't prove it.
No, you can't ask the jurors to try to attempt to show that there was some prejudice, to create facts. The facts have to be in the record. And in this case, all they said was if this question would have been asked, someone would have given a disqualifying answer. And then where are the facts to support that? Well, they don't have any because
it's
sort of a bootstrap.
But you won't let them. I mean, I'm saying it may be right, but how can you say they don't have the? Isn't that like when you move to exclude evidence and then you comment how they didn't present any of that evidence, which is not allowed?
Well, Your Honor, the reason why there's a line and where Strong drew it is because there is this tension between impeaching the jury verdict and proving Strickland prejudice. In Neese and Anderson, for example, where you have the juror questionnaires, or there was I think Anderson involved a statement on the record by the potential juror about, who later ended up being a juror, about their views on the death penalty. That record provided a basis for an allegation in a post-conviction motion that a biased juror sat on the jury.
But in effect, you're saying you can never prove prejudice from the failure to ask a question?
When there's nothing in the record to suggest
The failure to ask the question, right.
You can't do it by calling jurors to impeach the verdict.
I'm trying to get you to, is there some other way you could do it, or in effect are we saying you could never prove prejudice in that circumstance? Or is there some other mechanism you could use to prove it? And that may be a good law or bad law, but I'm trying to clarify what.
There may be a mechanism, Your Honor. I'm not thinking of one right now, but the mechanism cannot be to get the jurors under oath and start questioning them about how would you have answered this question? Because then the next step is, and why Strong is such an important case in this is because of this tension, there has to be a line drawn. If there is no presumed prejudice on failure to ask or failure to conduct a proper voir dire, Strong effectively says there's no presumed prejudice. The prejudice proof is the fact that in those cases, you had a biased juror that actually sat on the defendant's case. If you stop and think about Strickland, you have to prove that the result of the proceeding would have been different. And that involves the reliability of the verdict.
And you could prove prejudice of a jury from statements the juror has made or comments the juror has made to other persons as opposed to bringing the jurors in and questioning them.
You could. I think in that situation, Your Honor, if you had a situation where a juror gave a false statement during jury selection, and if there was an allegation that the defense counsel knew about that but failed to adequately follow up during jury selection, then I think you could call the juror about the falsity of that statement, but not on what they thought about or what they were, how they went about deciding the case. In this situation, what you would end up having to do is, and the reason why Strong drew this line is, the prejudice component is really not, did you answer this question on the questionnaire about the death penalty? Did you make these statements? But the real prejudice inquiry is, well, did you consider both punishments?
Well, and the issue is, it doesn't ask them that. I mean, in this case, the question that would be asked tries to get them to speculate as to what their position was on the issue after they have been through this whole trial and gone through that. So they have to recreate what they might have answered when the experience may make them a different person than they were at the time they would have been answering the question.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's why in a later case, not a criminal case, but Fleshner, a case involving impeaching the verdict, how do you go back then and answer a question 2-3 years later? How can you assess the reliability of that answer, especially when the person answering the question knows that they could undo the final verdict in a criminal case and may have been pressured in some way or another? And
for the Fleshner case, the it was undone. The trial was
That was a civil case, Your Honor. Yeah, Fleshner was. But I believe Judge Russell's comments about why we do not allow impeaching of the verdict applies here. Because to really get to Strickland prejudice, the state then should be able to ask, if they asked this question, the person said, well, you know, no, I wouldn't have considered, I would have answered this question, no, I won't consider it. But then why couldn't the state come in and then ask, well, you heard the instructions, would you have been able to follow the instructions of the court, or did you follow the instruction of the court? Well, yes, I could follow the instruction of the court. And in fact, during deliberations, we did consider the evidence of the defendant's childhood abuse and neglect. When you start going down this line, and I think Strong drew the line at the proper point, we will not allow juror testimony to impeach the verdict, especially in these cases involving jury selection. And you already have two other cases, too. You have Glass and you have Morrow. We talked about Glass was specifically evidence of the defendant's background, and that the claim was trial counsel was ineffective for not asking during jury selection about that. And the court in Glass said, well, you can't prove prejudice because you can't show that any biased juror sat on the jury. And the only way to have done that, and what's what they're trying to do now, is, well, let's haul all the jurors in and just start asking them hypothetical questions and see what pans out. But
and I think what Judge I don't want to speak for Judge Stitt, but I think what she's asking is maybe even if we believe that it is a valid and there is a good policy reason for not bringing the jurors in to question them about their prior thoughts or about that, is the test that they have to prove that the prejudiced juror served on the jury, is that the right test? To prove prejudice, do you have to prove, is that an impossible standard? Maybe it should be because of the circumstances, but there are two parts to it. Is that the right standard? And then is it permissible to question jurors about it?
I think it's the right standard for situations like this.
Or it interplays. I mean, at what I was saying is since assuming we were to agree with you that this policy of protecting the jurors from these questions is paramount, does that make it fair to have that be the standard, or should there be some other standard? Because otherwise you're saying you have to prove prejudice, but because of other policy reasons, we're not going to let you prove prejudice the usual way. Is it fair then to set that normal standard? Should there be a different standard? Because otherwise it's really, in effect, saying, sorry, once 5 years over, that's it.
Well, no, and I think there are cases out there, Nice, Anderson, Court of Appeals cases that are in the briefs, where that standard, the proving a biased juror sat on the jury, is not impossible to prove because the record shows.
Well, from answers given, but I'm saying and maybe the answer is you just can't prove it, but where it's from something you fail to ask, we've set up a situation where you can't prove it.
And I think that is very well the case. You can't prove it by asking the juror, well, how would you have answered that question? The policy reasons behind not harassment of jurors and behind not impeaching the verdict is just too great to just allow anyone, any PCR counsel can think of a question that should have been asked, and then to haul jurors in every case and see if someone shakes, see if you can get an inconsistent answer and bring that up on appeal.
Plus, as the questions asked, trying to recreate a situation after the fact, how do you know what you would have said before?
And that's exactly right. You can't rely on the credibility of that, and that's why we don't allow impeachment of the verdict, because after the fact, well, who knows what you would have done at the particular circumstances. And we really don't, none of this really needs to be addressed by the court in this particular case, other than it, to reaffirm the strong holding about that you cannot do this questioning of jurors to prove a Strickland prejudice because, well, first, there was not a proper pleading. There's nothing in the record to suggest that any juror would have answered that question adversely. In fact, the record suggests just the opposite. They were specifically asked, if you hear evidence about defendants' abused childhood, would it cause you to be unfair, you know, one way or the other? Could you still be fair to both sides? No one responded. Everyone, in effect, agreed that they could consider it. Mitigation evidence was discussed during death qualification, and no one, whether they were asked specifically, whether each juror was asked specifically or as a group, everyone agreed that they could consider mitigating evidence as well as aggravating evidence equally. No one said that they couldn't do that. So on the record, there just aren't any facts that they could have alleged that would have suggested that a biased juror served. Also, trial strategy. It appears, even though at the time, our trial counsel during the post-conviction evidentiary hearing stated that he didn't remember or he didn't think there was a trial strategy reason for not asking this particular question. At the time, he objected when the prosecutor asked the jury panel whether they would view childhood abuse and neglect as an excuse for committing murder. He objected to that question, did not follow up with one of his own. During death qualification, at least on one panel, he told the jury panel, and defense counsel told the jury panel, that I'm not going to get into facts of defendant's case regarding mitigation because it's not appropriate for me to do that here. It's appropriate.
Raising the question as an excuse versus a mitigating factor could be a reason to object to the question.
And that's also true, Your Honor. But then that follow-up during death qualification, he didn't want to get into their views about childhood abuse and mitigation. And to say that maybe he did not remember what his trial strategy was, but there was obviously a trial strategy going on, a reason why he did not want to get into that. And in the brief, I surmised that, or the state surmised that, he didn't want to expose anyone that had that in their past or would have views that the state could then target for peremptory strikes. And the strategy here was not to present childhood abuse and neglect as an excuse. Trial counsel very specifically said that we wanted to show this these bad circumstances of how this affected Mr. Deck's life, not as an excuse for murder because we know that's going to ring hollow with the jury, and it may prejudice them against us. So there was a trial strategy reason not to get into this particular items about childhood abuse and mitigation. It's clear from the record that they wanted to avoid that.
What was the context of defense counsel's answer in post-conviction proceedings that asking the question would push it?
I believe that is based on this court's opinion in State against Clark, that the general rule is you cannot disclose facts of the case during jury selection. And the reason for that general rule is you don't want to get jurors a biased presentation of what the evidence that they haven't even heard yet, or seek an improper commitment. Well, if you hear this evidence, well, are you going to fairly consider the case? And when you start doing that, things can start running amok, and so the general rule is you can't do that during jury selection unless the issue involves a critical fact. And in Clark, the critical fact was it was a murder of a very young two or three years old. And the court in Clark, which was a direct appeal, had nothing to do with post-conviction. The court in Clark, the circuit court, precluded the defense counsel from asking any question whatsoever about the age of the children and how it would affect the potential juror's ability to be fair in that situation. And this court simply held that on that limited context, for a critical fact such as that, the murder inexplicable murder of a young child, that some, they should have been allowed to at least ask some question about whether the jurors could be fair or not. Childhood abuse and neglect does not rise to the level of a critical fact under Clark that would allow for the asking of specific questions about evidence in that case. And second, Clark, like I said, was not a post-conviction case, and just because a trial counsel would have been able to ask a question about a critical fact doesn't mean you are ineffective for not asking that question, especially when the record somewhat suggests that there was a trial strategy reason for keeping it more general and just asking the potential jurors whether they could consider mitigation evidence. And it was explained and it was defined for them what mitigation evidence is. They all said they could do that. And just one more thing about in Nice and Anderson, the two cases where there was a finding of prejudice that a biased juror actually sat, those two cases show, and there are other Court of Appeals cases that show that this can be proved, that there can be facts in the record that will show that a biased juror actually sat. And the court's line in Strong works both ways. So in Nice and Anderson, the state couldn't then haul those jurors in and who answered those questions on the questionnaire about the death penalty and then try to shape them from, well, and in fact, if you read what they answered, it doesn't say that they would not have considered mitigation evidence. It was basically general views about the crime and how the death penalty should be administered. But the line in Strong prevents either the state or the defense from impeaching the jury's verdict by asking jurors specific questions when the record shows that they gave an answer in indicating a disqualifying bias. So the rule does run both ways for both sides. Unless the court has any other questions. Thank you
very much.
I just have a few brief responses. The circuit court didn't find that there was any trial strategy, and the record doesn't support a trial strategy reason for not asking whether the jury panel would automatically reject evidence of childhood as mitigation. During the general voir dire, the prosecutor asked if anyone there had suffered through themselves child abuse, and if they heard about it then, would that, you know, cause them to be unfair, bring back memories, that sort of thing. That was not objected to. It's when the prosecutor phrased the question in terms of, if you hear evidence of troubled childhood, is there anyone here who believes having a bad childhood is an excuse for having committed a crime? I mean, they were arguing their case. The defense counsel objected that it was calling for a commitment, and the trial court sustained it. So the questions that were asked by the prosecutor, he was really injecting his theory that child abuse is an excuse, which was his theory at the trial, as it dealt with the mitigation. So there wasn't, this record doesn't support any trial strategy reasons, and the attorneys didn't offer any trial strategy reasons. I wanted to bring up one other case which is cited in the brief, Johnson versus Armantrout, and in that case, the panel defendant's panel that they brought in had previously been the same panel for a co-defendant, and some of those jurors actually served on his jury, and there was a ineffective assistance of counsel claim for failing to remove those jurors that had been on the co-defendant's case, and they were now jurors on the defendant's case. And in that particular case, the Eighth Circuit refers to the fact that the circuit court at the state post-conviction level called the jurors, and the jurors talked about being influenced by the evidence in the earlier case and this case. Not all of them, though. And two of them said they were. One of them said it didn't make any difference, and one of them said I think they couldn't remember. So I think that calling the jurors doesn't mean that they're going to be easily swayed or that somehow they're going to be manipulated. And as I said before, that's been done in many other instances. I've done post-conviction non-capital for years and years, and very rarely have I ever contacted the jurors. In fact, I don't know any of my fellow public defenders that do that on any regular sort of basis. And I think you could look at Missouri case law and the opinions that come before, or the cases that come before this court, and rarely are there any issues, because post-conviction attorneys know that you can't call somebody unless you have a basis. There's an ethical obligation that you have.
What about the what you are wanting them to do is to try to create what their position might be a lengthy period of time with a significant event, and your co-counsel characterizes that you would be asking for unreliable testimony because they will be speculating as to how they might have answered that question at a prior period of time with significant events in between.
I mean, I think that you'd have to be careful about how you ask them the question.
But even
I understand that problem, and it is a problem. I mean, I acknowledge that will be a problem. But what other remedy is? I mean, Carmen Deck was entitled to competent representation during the voir dire. That's a critical part of the trial. You have to uncover bias. That's the main purpose. And if you don't ask the questions, I mean, how else are you going to be able to, if you don't presume prejudice?
But I think one of the tenets of our system is that we don't accept unreliable testimony, and we certainly wouldn't use unreliable testimony as the basis of a ruling.
So I suppose
it is inherently unreliable.
I wouldn't say that it's inherently unreliable. I mean, there have been a lot of, that this court relied on juror testimony in the Zink case. This Johnson versus Armantrot, they called four jurors at the state post-conviction. One of them said they didn't.
Juror testimony. I'm talking about where you're asking them whether they would have had a bias or what they would have thought about something at a much prior period of time. Do those other cases have that similar nature of what the inquiry was of the jury?
No, I don't believe so. I don't think that they were asking them. I think in Johnson v. Armantrot, they were asking them, did the testimony from the earlier trial influence this trial? So they were having to go back. So that would be and they were able, I think jurors are able.
Was it the testimony or just the voir dire questioning? They were on, they didn't actually make the panel, did they?
Right, it wasn't a.
They were part of the big panel, but they didn't actually make it.
Right.
So the issue in that case was whether or not the prior voir dire about this same factual circumstance affected their decision.
Oh, I'm sorry. They were jurors on the co-defendant's case, and then they ended up being jurors on the defendant's case.
They actually served in that case?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So. Are there any more questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.